This is the United States Eventing Association's official podcast. Hello, I'm Chris Stafford, and on this week's episode, we're going to be focusing on equine welfare. Later on in the program, Dr. Stephanie Davis will be here to give us advice on keeping your horses cool during the heat of the summer. But first of all, we're going to hear from Dr. Catherine Cohn, who is leading the cardiovascular and pulmonary study that has been taking place over the past few years. And she joins us now to bring us an update on the progress that has been made for this study. Catherine, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
So let's start with a little overview to remind our listeners, Catherine, as to what this study is all about, because it's been running a little while now, hasn't it?
Yes, it certainly has. The study was inaugurated in response to a series of equine fatalities that occurred during competitions, both horse trials and three-day events. And there was concern among competitors, judges, riders, everybody, about why this might be happening. And one of our hypotheses was that that horses that, although they might be normal at rest, could develop during intense competition, such as on the cross-country course, an arrhythmia or irregularity of the heartbeat that could reduce their ability to perform and in some cases be so severe that it might lead to a fatality. So one of the cardiopulmonary research group was born focusing on this idea that there could be heart or lung problems that might severely limit performance in some apparently healthy performing horses. And so we started out some years ago by doing a sort of stress echocardiogram on a few horses at a horse trials. And we always have a sample of convenience in this study. That means that we're dependent on riders, owners, and horses to volunteer. So I think we had about 20 horses in that study. And we actually did echocardiograms or sonographic images of the heart on those horses before they competed, at rest, or at least before they did the cross country, and then as quickly after the cross country as we could. And we were able to get images on all those horses, and we didn't see any huge abnormalities in the hearts, looking at the sonographic pictures. So that gave us, although it was, of course, a very small number of horses, but it did give us make us think that, we probably weren't fielding large numbers of athletes who had some actual structural heart problems, or that the competition induced some structural change in the heart that might be potentially harmful to the horse. So that's where we started. And then we also thought that we needed to be able to monitor the electrical activity of the heart, which means an electrocardiogram, while the horse was competing. So this type of procedure is done in people, where, of course, it's easier to make electrodes stick to the person, and the person can help you by trying to keep them in place. But we needed to develop a system that would stay in place, and there could be a recorder of all this electrical activity actually riding on the horse, because we couldn't use a telemetric system since the horse gets too far away on the cross-country course to make that work. That turned out to be quite a difficult problem. It's hard even in people. But thanks to the efforts of two members of our team, we were able to modify their system and develop a special three-electrode system that lives under the saddle and the girth that will record electrical activity. So then we went to a large number of horse trials and made recordings from horses' hearts during competition. And again, it's a sample of convenience. So whoever was willing to volunteer, those are the riders that we studied. And I think we finished up with getting usable recordings at about five competitions. And they were located in the Northeast, one in California and one in Georgia. So we had sort of a broad geographic range and as widely variable a population of volunteers as we were able to manage. So after several years of making these recordings, we eventually had about 130 recordings that are what we call, that we actually got data. And of those, about 70 of them, these aren't the exact numbers because I'm not looking at the piece of paper right this minute, but in that range, where about 70 of them were readable. Some of them were borderline, and some of them were just uninterpretable. So we had about 60% of our recordings that we thought gave excellent, you know, very interpretable recordings. About half of those recordings came from horses that were competing at training level or lower, and the other slightly less than half came from horses competing at the preliminary or above levels. So after each event where we worked, we did a quick and rapid a scan sort of all of those recordings. And because of the way the project works, of course, we have over an hour of data on most horses. Because we had to place our recording device on the horses before they would go off to warm up for the cross country. Sometimes that meant before the show jumping if it was a horse trial. So we then would have a recording of the horse a little bit at rest during warm up, maybe during the show jumping, during the cross country warm up, the cross country, and a little bit of rest after cross country or recovery after cross country. So that leaves you with sort of an hour or better of data that requires minute evaluations and measurements. And that's what we're doing now. So that very in-depth look at all the data is not finished. But in the overview, our result was that we did not find any egregious or irregularities of horse heartbeats that could we thought would be really a safety concern for the horses. So we didn't find, for example, atrial fibrillation occurring intermittently in these horses that were competing, which is a very severe arrhythmia and which certainly can limit performance. And we know it does happen. But luckily, we did not find it frequently in these apparently healthy horses. So that was our primary result at the moment, that we haven't seen anything big, and that's very good news. There are irregularities of heartbeat in there, but they are the type of irregularities for which the clinical significance isn't known at this time, and they don't, as far as we know, represent any kind of threat to the safety of a horse on course. So that's an overview of the data that we have at this point. Any questions about that so far?
I'm just curious as to the time frame of all this. Do you have a long view of this as to how long it will completely take to do this and publish your findings,
sure,
Catherine?
Well, we really wish that we had the funding and time to go on for much longer, but we have decided to stop collecting data at this point, Chris. And the reason for that is that, as you can imagine, all the researchers are volunteers themselves. They are all veterinarians in practice. And, you know, when we go to a competition, it's 3 or 4 days and, you know, it takes a lot of equipment and so on. And what we found was that what we wanted to do was recruit a lot of horses competing at higher levels, but that is very hard to do. These are very high pressure competitions and people are very, very focused on competing. And so in a volunteer population of actually competing horses, we had, as I said, less than 50% of our population was people competing at the upper levels. So since it didn't look like we were going to be able to actually recruit a lot of upper level people, we've decided that it was time to analyze our data and push forward with the publication on our findings at the moment. We can always do more work. This is certainly a preliminary study, but I think it's important that we get our data out there now, what we have. I would say that I think within the next year, we will have submitted this information for publication, hopefully before that.
Okay. And was one of the questions that was raised some comparison between how eventers' hearts are working now compared to in the short format compared to the long format? Was that a possible outcome from these findings at all, Catherine?
I don't think so, because we started our studies after the long format pretty much was gone. If memory serves, I believe it was around 2009 that we did our first echocardiographic study at Plantation Field in Pennsylvania. And I believe that the long format was not, maybe not totally gone, but gone and or on its way out. And we therefore made a conscious decision not to try to record data from the few long formats that survived, because we that's not the way the sport was going. Certainly there could be differences, absolutely, but we can't answer that question from these data.
Wonderful. And obviously this is ongoing. As you said, you're going to be publishing the findings in a year or so.
We hope within the year, and we aren't collecting any more data at this point. So the actual field work is over for the moment, at least with this study. And we are going on with our sort of labor-intensive evaluation of all the data.
An evaluation, right? The analysis is what I meant. Yes, that takes such time to break that down.
Right. You're right. It does it. But we do have a few recommendations for people at this point. And so I can talk to you about those if you'd like.
Yes, absolutely. I think they would be very helpful for our listeners.
And it's really common sense. But our feeling is, having looked at these at least 100 and some horses carefully, that auscultation, or listening to the horse's heart at rest and right after exercise, gives you, you know, at least some idea of how your horse's heart is behaving. And so we think it's that one way to reduce the risk of having fatalities during competition is to be sure that horses with a high risk or with a risk of a problem when competing just don't compete. And so what we strongly recommend for owners and riders is that before a horse goes off to compete the first time, some veterinarian should carefully listen to the horse's heart, listening for irregularities in the heartbeat and murmurs, abnormal sounds indicating that the blood is not moving through the heart in a normal fashion, that there might be a problem with a heart valve or something else. So we suggest that your veterinarian or the rider's veterinarian have a good listen. If the horse is normal, great. Decide that you're going to do that again in a year and make sure that everything is still normal, because things can change over time. But if the veterinarian does find an irregularity or abnormality, then the horse should be referred to someone who has advanced training in equine cardiology. There are some actual board-certified cardiologists out there. There are also a lot of people who do look a lot at the equine heart. And so there's people that's what they do. So the horse needs to go to someone like that for a complete echocardiogram study, so imaging the heart, to be sure there are no abnormal heart valves or size of any of the heart chambers that could predispose a horse to arrhythmias. For example, we know that if a horse has an enlarged top chamber of the heart, an enlarged atrium, then its likelihood of developing or its risk for developing the severe arrhythmia, atrial fibrillation, is quite high. So we definitely would want to make sure horses weren't with actual chamber enlargement of the heart were not competing. So the echocardiogram we recommend, and then also an electrocardiogram to make sure that there's no subtle arrhythmia or subtle abnormality in the electrical activity of the heart that could be there and could cause a problem. And having done that, you know, if nothing is of significant risk is found, well, great, then you've done what you can to reduce risk. On the other hand, if there is an abnormality or an irregularity, then we need to assess how severe that risk is. And that can be done by a stress test. You're familiar with the concept of stress test for people. They put you on a treadmill and work you and study your heart while you're exercising intensely. Same thing with a horse. You can devise a gallop for the horse that will be sufficient to increase its heart rate up to the level that you might expect it to be at a competition, and look to see if any abnormalities occur. And so that's another test that can be employed in cases where a veterinarian may have a question about whether this horse has any risk for competing. Along that line, I would like to say that, as we know, the famous event horse Arthur was retired this year at the Rolex Kentucky CCI 4-star. And that horse was actually entered in competition, and On a routine evaluation of the horse's heart before the competition, the horse's veterinarian found an irregularity that was worrisome. The horse was referred to a specialist. The specialist did not find anything concerning on the echocardiogram or on the electrocardiogram, but said, you know, gee, this is a very, very fit horse. This is a 4-star fit athlete. So we feel that the horse needs to have a significant stress test. And when that test was performed, there were irregularities of Arthur's heartbeat that were very concerning. And the cardiologist did feel that those irregularities would pose a risk for Arthur if he competed in the cross country course. So Allison, who has stated publicly she would never risk her horse's health, withdrew the horse. And this is, of course, very difficult for someone who's been training and competing, and this horse was going on to retirement, but she made the right decision. And we would just encourage everyone to follow her lead. If there is a significant risk, don't compete. And it's very hard. We understand that. But that's what needs to happen. We need to keep horses with high risk from competing. So we certainly are sad for Allison that she didn't get to compete, but she's an excellent example of how to reduce risk.
And you're recommending annual examinations then from what age though, Catherine? I mean, at what level of competition?
I think any level, any age. Just have someone listen to your horse's heart before you compete. And it doesn't have to be anything more than your veterinarian coming out and having a listen. But if your veterinarian finds something, then that should trigger a more advanced or in-depth exam. I don't think the age matters because young horses can have irregular or abnormal hearts, just like older horses, and certainly can have arrhythmias. So we did not, and we don't have all of our data analyzed, but at least in the data set we had in 2015, we couldn't draw a strong correlation with age, but we haven't, in other words, older horses have more problems. And that was true in the fatality data too, but we don't really have enough data, at least we don't have enough fatality data, which is actual horses that died, to make strong statements. So yes, age could be a risk factor, but that doesn't mean young horses can't have problems. And as we're looking to reduce risk, and this is an easy thing to do, we strongly recommend it. The other thing is, of course, before you purchase a prospect for an event horse, it would be good to be sure the heart is normal. So that's what we think people can be doing. Sorry, were you going to ask a question?
I was just wondering on examination then, I mean, we're stepping sideways to the conversation now, but an electro or an echocardiograph, would that be both be necessary for an examination of a potential event horse?
Well, not really. I still think that if the heart sounds normal, then, you know, I'm not overly concerned. As long as you have a knowledgeable person on the other end of the stethoscope, I think if the heart has a normal rhythm and there are no murmurs, that then further exam is not indicated. I think most people would not go ahead and do an electrocardiogram and an echocardiogram. Of course, you can do that, and it does give you more information. But I think just having somebody listen carefully to the horse is important.
That will give you enough information. Well, finally, Catherine, is there anyone else we should mention who has been part of these studies that you would like to acknowledge?
Well, if you don't mind, I would like to say one other thing, one other corollary to our studies.
Of course.
Here, which you think is, we can't overstate the importance of this, and it is a very difficult topic. But luckily, we don't have a very, very large number of fatalities, but everyone that happens is traumatic for everyone and bad for the sport. So we want to know why horses die when they die. And the only way we can try to learn that is by having an examination of the horse done after it dies, or so-called necropsy or post-mortem exam. And so we would like to strongly encourage everyone who is associated with a horse that unfortunately does die on course to have that horse have someone perform an examination of the horse's body after it dies. It's of course nothing that you want to think about in the midst of a terrible experience like that, and we sympathize with that. But each horse has the opportunity to give us important data. Why did the horse die? Because the more we know about that, then the more focused our studies can be. And what we're trying to do is really, on every fatality, it's reviewed at the USEA level and the USEF level. And we try to determine, okay, what could have gone wrong? And we look at what medications the horse might have been given. We look at its competition history. And we also look at data from the necropsy or postmortem examination. And we also have devised, our study group has devised a protocol for performing a necropsy on such a horse to give pathologists sort of an idea of what we're looking for. And then we try, if possible, to actually acquire the horse's heart so that we have a cardiologist who looks at all of these hearts and we can take tissue samples. We try to get tissue samples from the blood vessels in the, around the heart and in the lung, because we have determined in the horses that we've seen so far that we do see two things sort of repeatedly. One of them is that horses develop pulmonary hemorrhage. And I don't mean a little bit of blood in the lungs. I mean a lot of blood in the lungs such that the horse is unable to breathe. And secondly, we see horses that bleed into their abdomen as a result of a rupture of one of the big blood vessels in the abdomen, of which there are a lot. So we would like to collect tissues from blood vessels to bank and to study, because maybe we'll determine that there is some, say, collagen, and that would be a structural component of the wall of blood vessels that might be different in this population of horses. We don't know. But we would like to have a sample of tissues from those horses to keep in a bank in case we learn something that we can then go back retrospectively and look at those tissues. So the necropsies are really important, and unfortunately, they're sometimes quite hard to get. For one thing, the tissues are very susceptible to decomposition after death, and so it's important that the horse be transported to a cold storage area really quickly, and that the necropsy is done hopefully within the first 6 to 12 hours after death. Because when we try to look at tissues at 24 and 48 hours, things are complicated by a lot of tissue loss and destruction. We still can see major blood loss into a body cavity or into the lungs, but we can't get the fine detail that might help us. So I just would like to put in a plea for people to understand why that's so important, and to really strongly consider allowing us to do those examinations.
That was a good point. I was going to ask you about the deterioration of tissue, Catherine, and it obviously deteriorates so quickly. There's obviously no way of preserving it so that you can continue to study it.
Well, the important thing is, well, we could use preservatives once we get like formalin, once we get the animal in a necropsy situation. But I've seen horses packed in ice, while you're waiting for transport. The main thing is to transport them quickly. And the USEA can help competitions figure out where the closest facility would be. And, you know, you can make arrangements with, say, look, you know, if I have a fatality on the weekend, can someone come in and look at the horse, or can we at least get it into your cold storage area? There arrangements can be made. A crisis plan is necessary because, you know, it does require transport, and it's not easy if you have to figure all that out on the spur of the moment.
And of course, as you said earlier, it is a very emotional time. It's a very hard time.
Absolutely.
To be thinking about medical research, veterinary research. So a very good, I think, call at this time to our listeners to hopefully recognize this in their moment of grief, that it can be tremendously helpful for future equine studies.
That's right. The horse has something else to contribute. We realize that's very difficult. I certainly do want to acknowledge some of the people that I've been working with. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge the support of the U.S. Eventing Association, which through donations supported the cost for this project and continues to support it. I should also mention that the USEA and the USEF are strongly support the concept of necropsy and will try to help make this happen on the local level. And I have been working primarily with Drs. Mary Durango and Joe Slack. They're both from Pennsylvania. Dr. Durango is in private practice doing with Dr. Rick Burke, and they're the focus of their practice is cardiac and pulmonary problems in competitive horses. They do a lot of race horses as well as the 3-day horses that we've been working with, and they work with any horse, any type of client wants to bring them any from any discipline. And they were the ones that originally developed the prototype for our recording systems that we now use. So couldn't have done it without them. Dr. Durando and is a board certified internist. Dr. Slack works at New Bolton Center at the University of Pennsylvania. She is also a board certified internist. So she works in the heart station at Penn with Dr. Ginny Reef, both of whom are extremely have great experience with equine cardiology. And then we're very lucky to have another core researcher, Dr. Carolyn Belcher, who is a PhD. She's really a statistician working with large data sets, and she's been very helpful to us in organizing our data and helping us to analyze it. Dr. Mark Hart and Dr. Kent Allen have also contributed to our efforts, as well as a number of other people.
Well, we appreciate everyone's efforts, Catherine. This is obviously vital research for the future of the event horse and other horses, of course, in other disciplines too, who will learn from this study. So my thanks to you and all of the team, and thank you for taking the time to come on the program and bringing us an update, Catherine.
I appreciate being asked, and I want to say that our summary update will, I believe, be available on the USEA website in the near future. And I think the update that with the 2015 update, I believe, is already up there. So for people who want to look at it, and we certainly invite questions from anyone who's interested can contact us through the USEA.
Wonderful. We'll certainly pass that along. Thank you very much indeed for your time, Catherine.
You're certainly welcome. Thanks for inviting me.
And as Catherine mentioned, you'll be able to find updates of this study on the website at useventing.com. Well, joining me now is Dr. Stephanie Davis, who's going to give us some advice about riding in the heat. We are right in the middle of the summer, Stephanie, and it really is hot. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me. Yes, absolutely. It's very hot right now.
And let's, before we start, to hear a little bit about your background, where you're based, and what you focus on.
So I have a sports medicine practice in Northern Virginia in the Plains. My husband, Chad Davis, and I both own the practice. And my background is, as far as, other than being a veterinarian, I've been an eventer my entire life. So this has kind of been what I've done and what I've studied. So it's just a particular interest and focus of mine.
Well, we know that summer in Virginia is as hot as anywhere, and there's plenty of event riders here to obviously be facing the challenges. But around the country, it is a problem once you get into the summer. You want to ride. You can't always ride first thing in the morning or in the evening, depending on your schedule. If you're professional, you're riding through the day anyway. So where would you like to start with some advice as to how to deal with the heat?
Sure. Like you said, ideally, if you could ride early or late, that would, you know, certainly solve a lot of problems. As far as, of course, everyone doesn't have that ideal schedule and will have to ride during the day and during the heat. So one of the biggest myths that I've heard my entire life as well, even when I was a kid, this is what I was taught, you know, was not to offer them really cold water, especially, you know, back in the day, we used to actually hold water from them before cross country, which now is astounding. They should have access to water at all times. So even if you have water with you where you're schooling or training, offer them some water during the break if they want to drink. Let them have as much as they like. And that's going to really kind of help them manage the heat. And when you're taking a break, someone else is jumping, find some shade. Anything you can do, something simple like that, that'll really help them deal with the hot weather.
Now, in terms of riding during the day, as you say, sometimes you can get in the shade, sometimes you can't, and you start to see your horse suffering a little bit in the heat. What should you do?
So, well, if they're genuinely suffering and panting and really having a hard time recovering, then your schooling should be probably done. Again, you should have some water available, and you can even just literally pour water in front of the tack, behind the tack. It doesn't matter. Again, you know, another myth is, you know, going over the large vessels or not to put cold water over large muscles. That's absolutely just douse the horse with cold water. Buckets and hosing are ideal. But if you have a sponge, you can sponge them down so you try not to get the rider or the tack too wet. But whatever you can do to help cool the horse. Again, another myth that is actually very interestingly argued, even among academics, is the need for scraping the water. It's actually better to just keep adding water to the horse continuously. The skin temperature will decrease and the horse will cool as you just continue to apply water. So the frantic scraping is actually not necessary.
That's interesting, isn't it? You know, you dispelled so many myths right there, Stephanie, because over the years there's been so much research on the effects of heat and humidity on the horse, especially in eventing and endurance. And in terms of, you know, when you watch that horse maybe start to get distressed and you're cooling down, but he's still not cooling down as he should, and whether you should continue to walk or not, whether you should jump off and lead them, what's your advice?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. I mean, certainly if they're in significant distress, of course, you're going to get off the horse and you're going to immediately start cooling. And that, again, is buckets of water, hosing, add some ice to the water to decrease the temperature of the water. Because, again, when we talked about, you know, dispelling that myth of not putting cold water over large muscles, it's not going to make them tie up. It's not going to cause muscle cramping. It's going to cool the body. So put as much cold water on them as you can. Certainly a horse who is in significant distress may actually be quite agitated and difficult to work with. So if they want to walk, let them walk and try and apply water as, you know, efficiently, but not in a panicking way, because it's not really helping the horse either. Because I've seen, you know, at a lot of events that the grooms are chasing the horses, trying to scrape them, like we talked about earlier too. And really, if you just let them cool, let them breathe, get it, just keep, you know, calmly adding the cold water as you go along, it's going to help them cool off the most efficient.
Now, what about the risks of them colicking when they've just had an extra effort? They've maybe been cross country or even just a show jumping around, and you want to cool them down, you want to let them drink as much as possible. Give us some ideas as to when we should be extra cautious, Stephanie, in terms of, you know, the risk of colic at any time during a day in summer.
Yeah, that's a very interesting question, because I think a lot of people will associate the dehydration with colic, but the whole point basically is you're trying to be preventative. So we're going to be offering all that water way before we get to that critical point of the horse having heat exhaustion or heat stroke. Because my goal, and quite honestly, in everything I do, is a preventative approach. So I don't want to try and teach people how to deal with heat stroke and heat exhaustion, because I don't want them to get to that point. And then the horse wouldn't actually ever get to that point of dehydration where you'd even worry about them being colicky. So I think typically a colic, so to speak, is not actually, you know, one thing that you would expect from heat exhaustion. They can appear uncomfortable. I think that's more just the stress of the whole event, of being so hot and not being able to cool themselves. They certainly can get very severe and can get weak and collapse, but that, like, again, if you do very simple things by being sensible, keeping them in the shade, keeping them cool, offering as much water, pouring as much water on them as you can, and riding at the most efficient part of the day that you can, you won't even get to that point.
And what other symptoms should we be aware of, Stephanie, you know, during the heat of the summer?
Yeah, no, I think that's really, really good to know. So if you're worried, you know, how do I know if my horse is too hot or having heat exhaustion? So then I know to stop and apply the water. They obviously, nostril flaring is pretty normal when they're breathing hard and working hard, but that kind of comes along with when it's getting severe, the nostrils are flared as big as possible. They're almost panting, where they're breathing faster but shallow. They'll, of course, have an increased temperature, decreased appetite and thirst often, which doesn't make any sense, a bit counterintuitive, but their body actually ends up kind of shutting down their drive for thirst when it's getting excessive. And they'll get tired, their performance will be reduced. You know, when normally you would put your leg on and the horse would jump forward, they're not so interested in moving as much. And then again, like I said earlier, it can actually get quite severe where you would appreciate weakness and collapse.
Now, how about feeding and giving hay, access to hay, when it is very hot and after a competition? What is the best timeline here and observations to be aware of when it's particularly hot, Stephanie? I mean, you're on the road.
Well, of course, on the road, maybe change the subject a little bit. But when you're traveling with them, certainly, I think we've all been taught, you know, to whenever you take breaks and stops, if it's a long haul, then you stop and offer them water. You can also offer them some electrolytes to try and encourage them to drink more during travel. And again, traveling during the evening or very, very early morning will be ideal for it to be cooler. Now, as far as eating, they should have access to fuel. They need to have their, you know, forage to keep the gut moving. And so I think that's also another myth. You know, when I was a kid, same thing, you know, they would tell us, oh, don't feed them grain that morning or pull their hay an hour before you go cross country, which is completely counterintuitive as you think about it now. They need their fuel for their body systems to work. So, you know, if you have a horse, maybe, as you mentioned with colic before, if they've been prone to impaction colics, maybe they don't drink that well, really simply, you could soak the hay. Even better, you could steam the hay, because that will infuse a lot of moisture within the plant itself that they would then consume. But those are really simple things that you can do, again, to try and increase the moisture content into the horse's system.
Okay, so there's some advice for traveling as well. We've touched on a little bit. Any more advice on traveling as well, and also in the barn, Stephanie?
In the barn, it's relatively simple. You know, again, they need as much clean, fresh water as possible at all times. Sometimes in the summer, you may have to hang an extra bucket, depending on how much the horses are drinking, because you want them to have as much as they need, as much as they desire. You could also, a lot of barns have fans in the stalls, which is really helpful to maintain, kind of control the temperature within the barn. And good ventilation is always really important, regardless of summer heat. That's very good for their airways. And you will also want to have some level of, there's lots of arguments on the salt intake and what you give. I think free salt or a salt block is completely appropriate. Sometimes with the free salt, though, it may, if you have the ratio a little bit off, they'll get turned off to it and they won't really want to consume it. So I personally prefer some level of a salt block, because then they'll consume it as they feel they need to.
Just another thought, Stephanie, you know, when you're traveling your way at a competition and maybe, you know, before or in between the phases or even afterwards, and you're waiting for other horses so you're not ready to go home, you load them onto the trailer, onto the transporter. Now, any advice there? Because it may not be as cool as you hope, even if all the vents are open and the doors and windows are open.
Because as a competitor myself, most of the places that you will haul to and have to tie them on the trailer, there's really no shade. You know, there's nowhere to really get them out of the sun and put them on the trailer. Again, can be pretty hot. The best thing you can do is make sure they have access to water. Same thing. But again, usually somebody has an extra hand. If you really have a hot horse, then I would find the shade, would find the water. to hose them down, take them for a walk, because standing in a hot trailer is really not ideal, and that's something that people, I think, are quite honestly very smart about, and will coordinate, you know, getting some of the horses that are done competing home if they have other horses that need to stay. And really on that part, I would kind of use your common sense on the best way to keep them as cool as possible.
Any other topics of this that we've missed? Any other final thoughts, Stephanie?
No, I feel like we kind of ran over a lot of the good topics. And the biggest things that I wanted to go over were some of the myths that are shockingly really strongly believed still, particularly the scraping. I've always found that at events, even upper level events, you know, people are frantically scraping the horses. And I think it just creates way too much activity. We need to cool them down. We need to kind of take a deep breath, definitely quickly take off the tack, you know, get everything done in an efficient amount of time. But the more you kind of jump on top of the horse, you're not really helping the cooling process. Just get as much cold water as you can on them and just keep the water going until they start to cool and the breathing begins to recover.
Wonderful. Well, whilst you're here, why don't you tell us about your involvement with Team Ride Safe and what our listeners should know about this?
Sure. So Ride Safe is a company that I started about 5 years ago, and it is a medical ID bracelet that can be worn instead of a medical armband. I work very closely with the USEA to get that rule changed a few years ago, and that was very exciting. But I will say my main purpose and goal for developing the bracelet was not only for competing purposes, but it's meant to be worn all day, every day. We, as horse people, we all certainly take a little bit higher risk than the average person of getting injured in a day with what we do. But you really, I hate saying it because it's very cliche, but you really can't plan for an emergency. You really can't. So if you have your medical ID bracelet on you all the time, then it's just one less thing to worry about in a day, and you're prepared if something happens to you. Quite honestly, most of the stories that people have told me about, oh my gosh, you know, this happened to me and I have my bracelet on, so they knew who I was or knew what my allergies were or could call, you know, my mom or my spouse, weren't even related to horses, quite honestly. And, you know, unfortunately, we experienced this personally last year. My husband was on his bike and was struck by a car. And thankfully, he is okay, but he certainly sustained some significant injuries. And the first person on the scene called me off of his bracelet because he had his bracelet on riding his bike. And so we were able to get there very quickly. The first responders in the ambulance were able to look on his bracelet, get his medical information so that they could focus on his care more than, you know, asking him 20 questions about his medical history. So my goal is bigger than just, you know, wearing them at an event, but it's also nice that people can wear them instead of the armbands as well.
For sure. Well, very helpful advice. And where do we find out more information about Ride Safe, Stephanie?
Yeah, you can go to our website. It's www.teamridesafe.com, like you're part of my team. And my cell phone number and my email are on there, so people have full access to me. It's probably best to email or text because answering the phone all the time is kind of difficult. But it's something I'm extremely passionate about and very close to my heart. So I really try and take care of everyone as they're part of my family. And I want to develop these bracelets in a way that each one is custom to each person. And it means them. It's more than just a bracelet. If it means something to you, you won't wear it. If you don't wear it, it helps you. So that's kind of my philosophy behind the bracelets.
Wonderful. Well, thank you very much indeed for coming on the program, Stephanie, and giving us the advice on riding and caring for our horses in the heat of summer. And good luck with Ride Safe. I appreciate you taking the time to come on the program. Thank you.
You got it. Thanks so much for having me.
And you'll find links to both of these topics on the website at useventing.com. And don't forget to follow us on social media too, on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, where you'll find all the latest news you can use, as well as updates as to when the latest episode of these podcasts are posted. And the podcasts themselves can be downloaded from the iTunes podcast store to any podcast app, such as Stitcher and Podbean. And you can also listen to them on the website by clicking on the Media tab on the homepage at useventing.com. Until the next time, thank you for listening wherever you are in the world, and enjoy your eventing.